So we are back into our discussions of this book, The Intimate Way of Zen, James Ishmael Ford. Oh, and I was gonna get in here and I was gonna pull up the Oxfording pictures. Let me see if I can. There we go. Pull them up. Quickly share them because he refers to them. Let's see. Hopefully, I have the capability of, yep, share. Okay, so this book is loosely structured around the Oxfording pictures, which are a portrayal of the path of spiritual practice that arose in China. And it begins with searching for the ox, and the ox is stands for whatever we want to stand it to stand for, right? It's the ineffable, it is liberation, it is what we are searching for, it is the truth. We are searching, so in the first picture, we're searching for the ox, and perhaps we don't even know exactly what it is we're searching for, or whether we will ever find it. And then the second is finding the footprints. So seeing the evidence of what it is that we are searching for. So we know we're on the right track. And then third is seeing the ox. So catching a glimpse of this, which we are searching for, which can be very, it's these, like I said, it's enlightenment is not an all or nothing thing. There are many enlightenments. So these are, moments of insight or things that we've managed to change in our lives that give us faith and pique our curiosity. The fourth is catching the ox. So now we're developing a relationship with this truth. We're starting to connect with it. It's still a bit of a struggle, right? And then the fifth is what we're talking about tonight, is taming the ox. So now there's a, although, he's still got a rope on the ox. And then, as you see further along, more things happen in our spiritual practice. But in this picture, which is what these chapters were about, this is about taming the ox. So when we have some sense of the truth, it's not quite as much of a struggle as it used to be, perhaps, but there's also a little bit of a sense that, we got to keep the ox on the rope or it might just wander off. So I will stop sharing there. In the book, he has his own versions of these pictures. So before I just move on to reading a little bit from his first chapter and commenting on that, any questions or comments about the pictures or anything? Feel free to jump in at any time.
So is this basically just the journey of finding the truth? If I'm trying to understand, I kind of came in the middle of things here, so I'm just like, oh, okay, I'm completely lost and ADHD brain's trying to connect the dots here.
Yes,
Okay.
indeed. All right. So I am just going to read a brief passage from this is from chapter 16, The Integration of Practice and Encounter from Ford's book, and then we are going to discuss it a little. So in the Zen Map of Awakening, he says, this is on page 137, if you like to follow along. We are at the fulcrum, halfway through the ox herding pictures. And it is here that the sense of steps begins to reveal something different. At this point, in very important ways, there is no past and there is no future. This, as it is the way. So then he's this next part is the poem that goes along with this ox herding picture. Don't lose the whip, hold on to the rope, or he'll buck away into the dirt. Parted well in perfect harmony, he'll follow along without any constraint. So James continues, our thoughts, which are such troublesome beasts, are tamed to some degree. We are still inclined to the mind road. That will be a truth as long as we are alive. But now, as our thoughts arise, we constantly notice that they do not have to lead to new thoughts. The cycles are there, but we can more clearly attend to the moment itself. That part of the cycle which requires no past and no future. We are truly present, and that moment is clarity itself. Like the deep ocean, there is both vastness and particularity. We are alive within it, and squalls and even hurricanes may pass, and the deep things remain. And all of this is present to us. We are present to it. We need to maintain our practice. The doing matters, but our whole approach shifts. Gradually, our insights and our practices find a certain harmony. Instead of relentlessly returning to the present moment begins to call to us. Sitting and walking and the other disciplines we've cultivated begin to cultivate us. The separation of the act and our being becomes less sharp. In Japanese Zen, this period is called Shōtai Chōyō, the long nurturing of the sacred embryo. An interesting image. A bit more than a collection of cells, there is a hidden motion, and if not interfered with, it will grow into something. In this case, sacred feels completely appropriate, holy, and mysterious. We need to keep an eye on the ox, but we are traveling in the same direction. So, I wanted to do about 10 minutes of small groups. So sorry, there's no more forewarning than that to the to the cloud host. Maybe like three, the usual three or four people per. Three is ideal. And to answer each person answering two questions. One is sharing one thing about your life that has improved with practice. And then the second, is there any way in which practice has become easier over time? So if any of you happen to be here tonight and you're like brand new to practice, you may or may not have anything in particular you could share at this point, but usually you don't have to practice for very long before some of this stuff starts to emerge. So one thing about your life that has improved with practice, and is there any way in which practice has become easier over time? And then so a little bit of sharing like that, and then we will come back together. So we just make it 10 minutes from the time that they begin. That'd be great. And those of you in here would probably. All right. Hopefully, got you thinking.
It's one back behind them.
So there's one line that I really liked from this section, which I wanted to throw out there and see if anybody has a another way, kind of phrasing it in your own words, a little bit of an explanation or relating to it, and that is, he says, the separation of the act and our being becomes less sharp. I'm thinking about particularly where maybe practice has become easier, right? We have a little bit more of that sense of the ox, you're going in the same direction with the ox most of the time anyway. And the separation of the act and our being becomes less sharp.
The fifth step in a sentence or two.
And this is one of the just from this previous thing that I read from him. Jinryu?
Well,
Yeah, I think then you can be seen.
you have to go up. I was thinking it's something I shared, but I don't think I'm unique in this. I think a lot of us in our group felt this way, but in the way I described it for myself is I am much more aware of how I feel and how I'm behaving with others, regardless of the situation, whether it's in a store or with friends or with neighbors, total strangers. I'm generally a happier person than I used to be. And so having to be polite, having to put a smile on my face, that's not, I don't have to do that anymore because it just, so the edge between the way I am and the way I feel like I'd like to be has softened significantly.
You. Denny?
Yeah, this is an interesting question for me because I've been asking or kind of noticing a change. Sometimes when I'm in sitting zazen, and my thoughts quiet down, I just feel like this, and I've tried to put this into words to myself, but I feel like this. There's this presence behind it all that is very calm and isn't judging and is just looking out. And it's kind of like what you were talking about on Sunday with not knowing and bearing witness. And sometimes I'm conscious of that, and more I'm conscious of that. But it used to be that I would do something, I would act in a certain way, and it would sometimes carry me away. It would just lead to some emotion or the next thought, and I'd just be involved in this chain reaction of acting and reacting, acting and reacting. And more I'm finding myself being able to be aware of that, whatever that is in the background that's watching me and seeing that, oh, here you go again, Denny, calm down and don't lose your balance. So anyway, that's how I interpreted that more and more I can just watch myself calmly and be aware of how skillful I am or unskillful.
Thank you.
Sure.
Yes, Jeff.
Someone waiting.
No, I don't think so.
See my hands miss. When I think about my early practice, I think back to a way of thinking, which was, well, now I'm going to read a book about Buddhism. Now I'm going to sit. Now I'm done sitting. So I've done this Buddhist stuff in those examples. I think it was later, maybe associated with taking Jukai, that I began shifting from acts to a way of being and a decision to make a shift and a commitment. And I think around that time, I was thinking more and more about mindfulness during a sitting episode versus the possibility of continuous mindfulness, a way of being mindful, as opposed to, again, these little moments of mindfulness. And so in more recent times, I find myself thinking about a way that it's continuous as opposed to these isolated moments and decisions around an activity.
Thank you. I think that ties in nicely with the other image that I really liked from this passage, which was that of the long nurturing of the sacred embryo. And I remember somebody in our Sangha recently mentioning that she just was so struck when she was pregnant that, like, she had like nothing to do with what was going on in her. I mean, but just kind of like practice, like, it does matter. It matters what you do, right? You have to take care of yourself and all that, but otherwise you're pretty much just not in charge of that growth. And I love that. I love that kind of sense of we make the good conditions for our practice, but we're not really in charge of making something happen, which can be really frustrating at times early on. Like, we kind of want to, you know, get our hands into it. Are we doing it? Can we do it faster? Can we do it harder? Can we, you know, I don't know. I mean, I another phrase that comes to mind is a description of a phase of practice, which of course can be repeated, which is wearing a head on top of your head. And I always felt like I was doing this when I was, you know, really trying to do mindfulness practice, right? Early on, like, I'm going to go for a walk. I'm going to be mindful during this walk. And like, there's a way that I made the walk miserable, right? Because I'm like, am I being mindful? I wasn't being mindful just then. I need to be mindful. And so it's kind of like adding a layer of something to life, which, you know, people around you who don't practice would be just kind of like, okay, you know, what is that? But I don't know. I don't know if there's a way around that time, right? Where we're just kind of trying to do this stuff. And I feel like over time for myself, it would have feels like I think of it as like, I become converted. Like, my being becomes converted to doing this. Think about this particularly with the precepts, where some of the precepts initially you may just totally be down with, right? Others, okay, I guess it's part of the list, right? But I feel like, you know, mindfully you trying to follow the precepts and then noticing, like, all right, you know, when I broke that precept, that did not have good results. That hurt. So after a while, it's like, no, you know, I don't even want to do that anymore. I don't want to do that because I know what happens and it hurts. So, yeah. Let's see. Anything anybody else wants to add to that before I move on to another section? Sense of natural practice. Rachel.
I've noticed I've become more aware of what's happening around me. I used to not be very aware of what was happening around me. I was not the most observant person in the world. A plane can crash and I'll probably not even notice it. It was that bad. But the more I practice Zazen and stuff, at first it was like, gotta be mindful. Am I mindful now? It's kind of like how you were doing it when you walk. But now I don't even have to think about, am I being mindful? It's less of, it's more of, I'm aware of what my actions are doing. I'm more aware of being part of the act instead of just acting. It's more, I'm more involved in it than I was before, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Thank you. Lovely. So let's see. On to the next chapter. Read another little section here. So this is from the chapter Noonday Devil. And if you like to follow along, it's on page 142. Within the course of our lives, those little numinous moments, lifting that fork, noticing the flower, feeling the evening air brush our cheek, those little numinous moments can turn sour. We can become frustrated at our lack of spiritual progress or just at anything. We're easily irritated. The many disappointments grow into betrayals, sometimes real, more often imagined. It hardly matters as we're feeling it, whether real or imagined. It's a lump in the brain, a demon of the mind. Boredom can be a big one, the big one. I had a period of time with involuntary sighs. I'm sure it endeared me to my companions. In the moment, I was fortunate. None felt they needed to intervene. Knowing there is a better place, somewhere else, comes in almost in a tie with boredom. Anyone long attached to a Zen center has met people who have fallen into that well. They come and discover this is the place for them, unlike all those bad places they've been to before. But sooner or later, more likely sooner, they uncover the harsh truth. This is simply another of those inadequate centers, temples, mosques, churches, monasteries, and off they go. The reality is that type of story is simply the more public version of such events. Most anyone who has started seriously into a spiritual discipline quickly discovers the harsh truth. It's filled with people just like them, like you, like me. And that can be a significant disappointment. When you meet the demons of disappointment, do you have the courage to ask them to stay and have a chat? So I imagine everyone here might be in a different place with this. I had at least a 3 year honeymoon with Zen where everything was awesome. Like the teachings were awesome, the teachers were awesome, the Sangha was awesome. But then yeah, it manifested many different phases and forms. Just a sense of, I mean, I have a very strong critical mind, right? So I'm the kind of the opposite of a Pollyanna. If I go into a situation, I can say, I can see what that's not working, that's not working, and that's not working. And so sometimes it kind of cracks me up to like, I'm here doing my best, pouring out my heart to the Sangha, offering talks and classes. And I think there's got to be at least a few people out there who are like me, right? And are just like, meh. I don't know. I think it's we've been emphasizing this too much, or there's not enough of this, or there's light of that. So at least, like, I'm not going to take it personally, right? Because I did it to my own teachers. But, you know, or it was dissatisfaction with people in the Sangha, with the way the Sangha is run, with the way that the Sangha, you know, sets their priorities. And, you know, it wasn't just my one place of practice. I could go to another place of practice. And I could be like, that's really dumb the way they do that. And when I went to Tatsuhara Monastery for a practice period, and I stayed for the summer to work and pay off that practice period. I mean, you would think that that would just be like my dream come true. And in many ways it was. During the practice period, during the intensive cloistered practice period, I was just in seventh heaven. Then summertime, like, now all kinds of guests come and they're there to eat fancy food and soak in the hot springs, and students are coming and going and teachers are coming and going, and like, I don't know, it's like I'm at the hot springs in California, and like I was just like, this isn't a real monastery. I want to be in a real monastery. You know, it's like this immense dissatisfaction came up. So the real question becomes, you know, do we want to? So, you know, there is a time to choose something else or to go somewhere else, right? It's not that that's never the case, right? Maybe you really are called to some other path or some other place. And, you know, if you are, like, more power to you, and can only hope that you find your heart's desire. But at what point is there kind of a commitment to, I'm just going to keep on doing this, even when I hit the dry times, even when it's like, I don't really know, you know, I don't know. I just do this because I do this, right? I'm not really necessarily seeing any, like, oh, this feels so wonderful and I'm getting so much payoff from it or whatever. Even when we have some sense of disillusion with Sangha or teachers or something like that, you know, I would just maybe it's like a little inoculation against when you hit that place, if you hit that place of dryness or dissatisfaction, I encourage you to kind of stick through it and stick on the path as closely as you can, because those periods don't last forever. Right? And we don't get to the place of a deeper relationship with the Dharma and Sangha unless we continue. I don't know if anybody has anything to say about that. If you have any comments, it might be like confessing that you feel dissatisfied sometimes, but I don't know if anybody maybe has worked through some of those dry times and stuck around. Anything you want to ask or add? Courtney.
I don't know if I have anything constructive to say, except I feel very called out about every previous community I've ever been a part of.
Yeah, me too.
And I think I was looking for the perfect, and it can be perfect in very controlled circumstances. And then when you look a little wider, you realize nothing is perfect. And the trick for me is between, like, how do you, I'm not asking, but I'm just to myself, I'm thinking, how do you know when something really isn't the right thing versus It's just not as perfect as you thought it was. And that's what I've had to struggle with in every previous community I've been a part of. So.
Yeah. The model, which is really, in Zen, is really a monastic model. So it doesn't necessarily apply entirely to lay practitioners. But if you get ordained, if you go practice in a monastery, whether you're ordained or not, the practice is basically shut the hell up. And you just deal. You just deal for a long time. Like, so it's really kind of like a boot camp kind of thing in some ways, right? It's just, you don't get to be like, I don't know, I don't really like that. Like, it's not an open discussion, right? This is the way that things happen. This is the time you get up in the morning. This is the job that you get assigned to do. These are the people that you get to work with. And it's not that we should idealize that in the sense that that's the way life should be permanently, but it is really, really helpful, useful practice to go through, right? And I did not spend my time in a monastery where everybody else was doing this practice. So in some ways it was harder, but when I wanted to get ordained and I was a postulant for ordination, my teacher, I have lots of ideas, I have that critical mind, right? And I was just a lay practitioner. I was just like, you know, hey guys, why don't we do this? And why don't we, you know, start this class? And why don't we do that? And whatever. And convincing people and all that. And so she said, like, all right, you know, enough with the ideas, you know, for your junior training. And she said, don't even change the way people put things in the dishwasher. It's like, me? Like, I still think about that when I rearrange the dishwasher at home, right? Don't even. And like that was a real, yeah, I mean, it. Not everybody's going to get the same lesson from that, but the lesson for me really made me look at all the ways that I was attached to the ways that I'm trying to improve and influence, and I am who, what I do, and I am my opinions and all of this. And if that is taken away, then what? What is my role? What is my legitimacy, right? And I had to, having that crutch taken away, that karmic outlet taken away, was very instructive. So, I mean, I don't know, that's an aside, is like, that's one, I like to think that the monastic practice is a literal enactment of something that all of us are trying to do to some extent, trying to practice with like letting go of having to control everything. Andy.
So I'm going to try to attempt to answer the question that you said set for us. The question has kind of faded a little bit, but I guess for me, as a Baha'i, Christian Buddhist Baha'i, as I currently identify, I guess, I believe very strongly in the oneness of religion, and I believe in progressive revelation, and this is me personally, believe that the duplicity or the multitude of religions arise because of the limitations of mankind. Mm-hmm. And so I believe, I told someone the other day that there's no particular religion or race of people that has a premium on the ills of mankind. And I remember even when I was becoming a Baha'i and my mentor was trying to convince me that the Baha'i faith was just so much different. And I was like, no, it's not. Because if it was, I wouldn't even be doing this. I'm doing it because it's not different, because it is the same. Like, I really buy into that idea. And you're just like, it's just, and I'm like, no, the same problems are there. Yep. Oh, there they go. And I'm okay with that. Why? Because people are involved. Every time people are involved. And so I guess I just kind of, for me, it's just kind of like a given. And it's just, okay, how tolerable is it? When like to sit there and like how much crap am I gonna put up with and how bad can I deal with it while it's there? Or, you know, or do I need some of those crap and some of that crap and limitations because I'm also crappy and limited in that area. So I need that to feel safe and secure and still feel like I'm right and good. So I guess for me it's kind of like there have been times where I get like disappointed in a community because I'm just like, oh man, you guys burst my bubble there. I thought at least you'd be different in that way. But then it's like I get reminded, well, you already knew. People are people everywhere, every place, in every group. So that I don't even know if I've I don't think I've ever had a honeymoon period in any religious community I've belonged to. Always just, I mean, but I'm very religious though. But I mean, not to say that I don't like, you know, but I mean, I love religious communities. But I don't think I've ever been like, oh, this community is so awesome. Everything's perfect about it. I've never experienced that. I'm kind of envious.
Yeah. I mean, there's the ideal of not ideal, but sometimes there's this vision in Zen of like going off into a cave to meditate by yourself, right? If only you didn't have to deal with all these people. But that is like in Chan and Zen. Is considered that is a practice only for extremely advanced practitioners. Because the rest of us need we need all of this stuff. I think my husband has a phrase, or he got it from a grandma or something. It takes all kinds, unfortunately. And there will be, I don't know, for many of us, there as you know, I have a beloved sangha, right? As a whole, we're just so grateful for the sangha and for a place to come. And I don't know, it seems pretty more often than not, at some point there will be someone in the sangha you do not mix with. Like your karma and their karma are like disaster, right? Like you don't understand each other, you resent each other, you hurt each other, you I mean, and I had more than one of these folks. I don't know, maybe I'm just particularly prone to this. And it was very I mean, I just it makes me sad to think of the number of times that I went to my teacher and explained to her, essentially, I didn't say this, but essentially I wanted to explain to her why this person shouldn't be part of the sangha. You know, like you don't understand. You don't understand what this person is doing and what they're like. Like, surely you will take some measures, you know, and they would always just be like, I mean, I'm not talking about ethical violations or abuse or anything like that, right? Like if people are breaking precepts or something, that would be called out. But you know, there's a lot of stuff in between. And I mean, it demands a maturity to remain engaged and to still value Sangha and hold this discomfort, this imperfection of it, which, if we can do that in Sangha, serves us very well, right, in the rest of our life, because that's just the nature of almost anything we're involved in. And you probably got an experience with that too, family, work. So. I don't have time to go on to the next chapter. We have 4 minutes. Any additional thoughts? or questions? Alice?
I mentioned in our little group there that my practice, instead of like wrestling with the ox, is more like riding the rodeo. And I feel like that's very true. I had moments of, not just moments, like I would say years, months maybe, of utter bliss. And then vacillates to doubt, despair, anger, frustration, irritation, boredom, listlessness. So I feel like it's like an EKG readout, you know, like really high peaks and really low lows, PQRS little, you know, EKG readout. But I realize that maybe what I'm chasing is not really the plus 10, but more like the zero.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing. It's a good reminder that, like, these ox herding pictures make it all seem so neat and progressive, you know, like you're just going to go like this. And once you have the ox on the rope, then it'll never be gone again. I mean, I think you, like, that ox can get away. You're wandering again through the forest thinking like, I don't know. I don't even know that I saw an ox. You know, back and forth and back and forth. And but you, I think what one of the things that these pictures point to, not that we want to get too literal and concrete about like, oh, have you seen the truth? And if you've seen the truth, then you're forever transformed and all that. But there is a way that there isn't going back, right? If you go back and you're, you know, wandering through that forest, you've lost the ox, but you know it exists. You've had it nearby. You know, so the search will never be quite the same as that initial sense of like, I don't know if there's even anything worth searching for in this world. All right. Well, dedicate the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time. All honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita.
Bye.
Hey guys.